You are Locked On Hawks, your daily Atlanta Hawks podcast. Part of the Locked On Podcast Network. Your team, every day.
Hello, friends, and welcome to episode 483 of the Locked On Hawks podcast. I am your host, Brad Rowland. It is Thursday. The Hawks are actually off today before they go take on the Oklahoma City Thunder on Friday night. So we'll have a podcast after that game that will be the next show. But today's show will be actually a mailbag podcast before we get to the actual questions. Though, one note for Friday night's game is that's the fact that the Hawks might be shorthanded again with Jeremy Lin actually being listed as questionable with the ankle injury that kept him out of the game on Wednesday. No word beyond that, but something to keep an eye on because Oklahoma City, of course, has a lot of potent guard play with Russell Westbrook and Dennis Schroeder, old friend of the program, of course. So we'll keep an eye on Lynn, and please follow me on Twitter and follow Peachtree Hoops and all that fun stuff to monitor that in advance of the game on Friday. But that's the one note, and now we'll get to the mailbag questions. So the first one comes from Jesse on Twitter, and they ask, should the Hawks consider a trade for Markelle Fultz? I will say this is a question I've been getting a lot, and I think it was spurred on by a recent podcast that Zach Lowe and Kevin Arnovitz did as well, mentioning that as an option. A lot of people have been talking about the fact that the Hawks, you know, as a team that's looking to the future and not the present, could be a team that could sort of buy low on Markelle Fultz. The first thing that I have to say, though, is that I really don't know what his trade value is, and no one really does at this point in time. It's something we've been talking about for a while now, and I think people that cover the league and are sort of around, and you know, even people that cover the Sixers have been wondering that kind of out loud for a while. It's pretty much unprecedented, honestly, when you factor in the medical weirdness there that's happening with him, as well as the fact that he's now been away from the team for a while, being evaluated for some physical stuff, and it's just very, very odd, obviously, when it comes to Fultz, as well as just all the weirdness there, obviously. And it's also a bad spot for Philly, in that everyone knows now that with their current roster construction, with Embiid, Simmons, and Butler, Fultz, as currently constructed, is just not really helpful to them really in any way. As someone who just can't shoot at all, can't space the floor, they just can't. It's a spot where it's a rough spot. We'll just leave it there when it comes to Philly. But I will say, as a player, his shooting is the big thing, of course, that no one can figure out, and that's the number one thing. I am of the mind that even if he can't shoot, that there could be a path for Fultz to be a pretty solid NBA player, even without a jump shot. But he'll have to obviously adjust his game for that and play to his strengths more. He's big, he's athletic, he can finish, he can facilitate, and potentially even defend at a high level. So there's a player in there, even if he can't shoot. But just the weirdness factor is something that we just haven't seen when it comes to Fultz. Beyond that, the contract stuff is very interesting for Fultz. I was tweeting about this week a little bit, but I think fans have the perception that he's actually going to be cheap because he's on a rookie deal, but he's not, honestly. He's the number one pick in the draft, and as a result, he's making a lot of money. This year, he's making more than $8 million. Next year, he's already guaranteed for the 2019-20 season $9.7 million because of the fact that Philly picked up his team option, and the year after that would be the final year of his rookie deal, and that would be a $12.3 million rookie option for 2020-21 that the team would have to decide, whichever team that has him will have to decide on within the next year. So some real big financial stuff to get through as well. Even if you were just trying to talk about the player, there's obviously a lot of complications there, but when it comes to Fultz, yeah, the contract too, whoever trades for him, and I think it's clear that Philly's going to probably trade him at some point, whoever trades for him is on the hook for, at a minimum, that $9.7 million for next year. And that's not a small fee. Honestly, I think it's pretty, even if you believe in Fultz, which I actually kind of do, it's kind of difficult to project that he's going to return value on that contract next year. That's kind of the big thing for me. It's more of a long-term project. I think that he can still be a good NBA player, but will he be a good NBA player next year? That seems kind of unlikely to me. So the excess value stuff is kind of tough to figure out. I do think, you know, it does make sense, as mentioned before, that a future-facing team like the Hawks or another team like that would make some sense for Fultz, because he's not going to help you now, but he might help you in the future. And, you know, in theory, it would make some sense for Atlanta because of the fact that Trae Young is already on board, and it kind of takes some of the heat off of Fultz. Fultz is also pretty big and physical. They could potentially play together down the line, and shooting is not going to be probably a problem for this team. They have Kevin Herter, they have Trae Young, they have Torrey Prince right now. They have some guys who can shoot it, so Fultz's shooting issues would not be as magnified in Atlanta as they are in Philly, where they don't really have a ton of spacing outside of JJ Redick. So regardless, for me, it'd be sort of an asset play for the Hawks or really any team if they were to get involved, because Fultz makes so much money. The Hawks would almost assuredly have to send either Dwayne Dedmon or Jeremy Lin to Philly to make the money work, because, as I mentioned before, Fultz makes a lot of money. Dedmon and Fultz actually are kind of close in salary, and Philly could use Dedmon's services, to be sure. Lin makes more than Fultz does, but if you threw in like Furkan Korkmaz, you can make the money work there. I think there will be at least a pick somewhere along the line there. I don't think that Philly's going to trade Fultz for a veteran without getting some sort of future facing asset back, whether that be a pick of some sort or a young prospect. Regardless, I think you don't want to be paying a lot. There was somebody that asked me this week if I thought the Hawks would trade essentially Lin and the Cavs first round pick that the Hawks are owed for Fultz and Korkmaz. I would not do that, just because of the fact that that pick is potentially perilous. Obviously, the Cleveland pick could evaporate and become 2 second-round picks. That's not bad value still for the Kyle Korver trade that actually was acquired for. But if the situation breaks down and Cleveland finishes, you know, with a 12th pick next year, I think if you're assuming it's an actual first round pick, it'd be pretty rough to be trading that away in a deal that you know only brought back Fultz as sort of a centralized piece. And not really even on a cheap contract. So all that to say, I have no idea what the Hawks actually think of Markelle Fultz. I don't know what Travis Schlein thinks of Markelle Fultz. He's never been someone that's been worth asking about, because of the fact that, you know, when he was coming into the draft, he was number one pick almost certainly from the middle of the season on, and the Hawks are not going to have that pick. So it's one of those times where not a ton of prep work there on what the actual front office thinks about him. So I'll cop to that. I kind of just don't know what the Hawks might have interest in. But in theory, because they are looking to the future more than the present, I understand the question. I'm just not sure that it's anything more than a buy-low spot. And honestly, if you're paying a high price in terms of prospect capital or the draft or something like that, it's too much to do that for Fultz. If you somehow can get a great deal on him, then sure. But otherwise, I think it's probably not the right time, considering just all the factors in play and the fact that, you know, Atlanta's only salaries that make any sense are Lin and Dedmon. And, you know, the machinations there would be very challenging. Obviously, the other one would be Miles Plumlee, but I can't imagine that Philly's going to take on Miles Plumlee without some serious compensation. So all that to say, I'm not expecting a deal to happen, but it's not impossible. And Fultz does make some level of sense in Atlanta, even if I'm not sure that it's probably going to happen in the future. Before we get to the rest of the podcast, I do want to talk to you about the good folks at Action Heat, because this episode is sponsored by them, and Action Heat makes the world's best battery heated clothing. Heat on demand at the touch of a button, and control your environment with Action Heat, because they engineer and safely efficient they engineer safely and efficiently deliver heat via heating panels that are similar to a heated car seat. They can reach temperatures of up to 135 degrees. They have a lithium ion battery, and they last up to 12 hours on each charge. Action Heat batteries can be used to recharge your phone or even any other gadgets that you have while you're wearing them as well. The clothing that they make is perfect for any friend or family on your holiday gift list. It's perfect for people that work outside, or if they're skiers or snowboarders, or anybody that likes to just be outside, or people that just don't want to be cold, which certainly applies to a lot of people that in my life I know, as well as I'm sure everybody else's life. There's somebody that you know that just hates to be cold. This would be a perfect spot for them. Action Heat clothing provides toasty warmth and comfort for your whole body, including they have jackets, they have socks, they have gloves, they have hats and undergarments like heated-based layer shirts and long johns, and every single one of those things is heated, so Action Heat provides a lot of versatility there as well. They also make men's and women's clothing, and they have great new styles and models that are just released for this particular winter season. So make the winter activities that you're doing more enjoyable with a blast of warmth and with Action Heat. It's definitely been something that I've wanted to look at, and Action Heat's been a fantastic resource, and honestly, it's still pretty cheap as well, with budgets starting at $39.99, and that's a pretty good deal for something of this quality and this value. So to talk about how do you want to get this stuff, it would be to go to actionheat.com/lockedon, actionheat.com/lockedon, to get 20% off your entire order by checking out Action Heat today. That's actionheat.com/lockedon. Use that coupon code LOCKEDON at checkout to save 20% on your order. So stay toasty warm with all your outdoor activities this winter and this holiday season with Action Heat. And we thank them for sponsoring the podcast today. Thanks to Action Heat for sponsoring the podcast, and here we are to talk about the rest of these mailbag questions. The next one comes from Astro Joe, and he asks, if all players in Atlanta's young core, who do you think projects as the best two-way player? Let's assume the choices are Young, Herter, Spellman, Collins, Prince, and maybe Bembry as well. I will say, The two-way player thing kind of bothers me a little bit. I know what the question's asking, and shout out to Joe for the question. I really appreciate all the questions that came in when I asked for the mailbag stuff, so thanks for the listeners for doing that. With that said, I don't love the two-way thing just because I think that sort of has a weird connotation in a lot of ways, and I think it's overused. With that said, I understand the impetus for the question as someone who's, as players who can be good on both ends of the floor. That's kind of the overarching theme, the way it probably should be used. With that said, I think that Trae Young is the best prospect overall, pretty clearly, out of this group. You know, obviously, he's not the best player right now. I think Collins is obviously far better than him right now. But I think Young's ceiling is the highest, unquestionably, of this group. I don't think that he's going to be a good defensive player, though, at any point in time. So if you're talking about two-way guys in the way that it's traditionally discussed, you kind of have to cross Young off because his defense is just never going to be there in that way. I'm also removing Prince and Spellman, honestly, for me, for defensive reasons. I think Prince is legitimately bad defensively at this point, and given the fact that we're in year three, he's a little bit older. It might happen at some point. He might improve, but I can't project it. That's something I'll just leave there for now. Spellman the same way. I think obviously he has a little bit longer leash because he's still a rookie, but I think his defense was the problem that I had with him as a prospect in the draft. I don't really see Spellman becoming anything better than below average defensively. I might be wrong on that. I'm willing to admit that, but given the context of the question, I think I'll take him off the list as well. I'll remove Bembry for offense. I think his offensive stuff is pretty well documented. We'll talk about it a little bit more later with one more question that we have to address. But Bembry, I don't really see him being a plus offensive player. Defensively, he's already there, but offensively, you kind of have to just live with what he can bring. And I think I'll take him off the list as a result of that. So that leaves Kevin Huerter and John Collins as the contenders here. I have very little doubt that Huerter will be a plus offensive player, and I think he's already better defensively than I would have projected during his rookie year. He's got good awareness. He's a good athlete, et cetera, et cetera. I think the concern would be that he's not terribly long and he's not very strong. I think the strength is gonna be improved, but his length can't really be improved at this point. I think it's okay to project some there, but I'm not sure he's gonna ever be like legitimately above average as a wing defender. I think he's gonna be average, which is that goes a long way with the way he can shoot it and play offense. But I'm not sure about his defensive upside, so I'll just leave that there for now. Collins, I think, is already a plus offensive big man, to be sure. Defensively, he's got some growth to have happen in the future. I think his leaps and bounds better already than he was supposed to be coming in. I thought he was really bad in college, and I think that was kind of almost universally acknowledged about how bad he was defensively in college. But I'm not sure, though, he'll ever be, like, flat-out good defensively. Like, he might be average or maybe even a little bit above that. Getting to flat-out good is different, and I think because he's kind of a tweener, it's kind of a tough evaluation. Something I've been talking about for a while is that this core, most guys, Bembry's the only guy on the core right now, and Bembry's obviously probably the lowest member of the totem pole here of the guys we're talking about. He's the only guy who's better on defense than offense right now. It's kind of tough sometimes to build that way, but in the two-way player conversation, I think both Huerter and Collins can be solid defenders. There's not much beyond that. I do think I would choose Collins for the answer to this question. He's the safest bet, in my opinion, because he's already a pretty good rotation player, so that's a nice place to start from. I do have concerns about him defensively long term, but not in the way that like I used to have, where I thought he might be unplayable defensively. Now I think it just might be a situation where he's never great defensively, but there's still enough two-way value there, and his offense is pretty impressive. So I'll go with Collins over Huerter slightly, and that's an interesting question. I'm glad we were able to acknowledge it a little bit. One question that actually stems from that a little bit is that Andrew asked, has John Collins shown enough that he can hold up defensively at the five? I was going back to the question before. I think we need to see more from him defensively just in general. And part of that is the fact that he's sort of a tweener, and he kind of always was, even before the draft. That still kind of applies for me. He's much better than I thought, obviously, but some of the size stuff and rim protection questions that you might have at center are still there, and I think some of the matchup stuff you might have on the perimeter are still there as a full-time four. I think a hybrid role is probably going to be what he's going to be best at moving forward. I think this year, obviously, he's the best four on the roster by a wide margin, so that's why he's going to play there a lot. We've seen him play the five a little bit recently, but honestly, this year we have not had a big enough sample for me to really evaluate him at the five. It's only been a couple of minutes and a couple of games, so we're going to need to see more than that. I still think, in my gut, I would say he's going to be better at the five than a four long term. But full-time defensive starting center may not be the best role for John Collins. We'll see how that looks in the future. So the defense holding up the five is definitely an open question at this point in time, and I really can't necessarily answer that at this moment. Last question that we're going to do, because this one's a little bit deeper, a little bit of a deeper dive, comes from Terry, and he says, I saw you tweeting about Trae Young's RPM numbers. Can you talk a little bit more about that stat and how it treats the Hawks so far this year? Of course, you know, Trae Young, when I tweeted it out, was actually dead last in RPM. It actually updated a little bit on Thursday morning, so he's no longer last. So shouts to Trae Young for that, no longer last. But RPM is sort of a black box. This is the definition, at least what's accompanying the actual stat. This is what they say that it describes, and it says, and I quote, it is the player's estimated on-court impact on team performance measured in net point differential per 100 possessions, offensively and defensively. RPM takes into account teammates, opponents, and additional factors, end quote. So talking about this a little bit with people around the league, RPM isn't really praised. It's not really something that people like in general. ESPN has this project, and because it's ESPN, it's very prominent. It's interesting to reference a little bit. I do think that there are some questions about the formula itself. It's because it's, as I said before, it's kind of a black box. There are themes you can kind of take from it in terms of evaluating. If you look at it enough, you know, players that have bad backups usually fare better because their team falls off the floor, falls off when they leave the floor. And the same thing works in reverse. If you have good backups, you're probably going to look a little bit worse. With that said, the exact formula is not really out there, and the controversial results kind of come out from there. So all that to say, I understand the RPM like jokes that are being had, and it's something that I'm going to reference because it's a pretty popular number and metric, but not everybody in the league loves it. In fact, I would say people that I've talked to, most people don't like it very much, and it's kind of a weird thing. Part of that's just not knowing what's in it, and that's always going to scare people off, but it's tough to use that one all-encompassing metric. There really isn't that kind of number in basketball. You know, PER is useful in some ways, you know, win share, that kind of stuff. There's different things that you can sort of all group together, but there isn't that one all-encompassing number, and RPM is certainly not that either. With that said, we'll come back to Young a little bit later on this, probably the last part of this question. But, you know, just writing down some stuff on RPM at the moment for the Hawks. Jeremy Lin, Kent Bazemore, and John Collins are the top three. No surprise there at all with the way that Lin's been shooting the ball. Obviously, offensively, he's been a top 50 guy on RPM offensively right now. Defense does not like him very much, but his offense is more important, and that's how he ends up in near the top of the list there. Also, Kent, you know, Bazemore's two-way stuff is something we pretty much talk about a lot. He's a very good player for the most part. Alex Lane, Kent Bazemore, both top 100 defensively. That's something that's worth filing away. Also, Deadman's in the top 120 himself. RPM does not like Torian Prince or Kevin Huerter at this moment. Prince is number 355. Huerter is 346. Prince, it's really both ends of the floor. Offensively, he's only about number 200. I think he's 199 right now. That's actually going to be surprising to some people. And it's actually higher than it was a few days ago after that shooting game the other night. He's 374 in defense out of, just so people know, there's 438 players ranked. So being 374 is really bad defensively. Also, Lin's 381, which feels out of whack to me. He's better than that. He struggled early on when he was coming back from the injury, which is some force stuff. But since then, he's been better. That's definitely too low. That's a good example of the stats kind of being funny. Amari Spellman's 394 overall, which is bad. Bembry's 398 overall. Bembry's number 425 in offense, one of the worst 15 players in the league offensively, and the worst guy on the Hawks. You know, he's bad offensively at times, but that's probably a little bit harsh, I would say, for him versus the rest of the league. Also, Deadman is outside of the top 400 offensively, another situation where that's definitely out of whack. I don't think Deadman's like a plus offensive player necessarily, but he's not number 400 something offensively in the league. That's kind of that's definitely way too low for him. Trae Young overall is obviously the talking point here. He's number 432 of 438 overall. He's actually ahead of a couple of other rookies, ahead of Marvin Bagley, ahead of Colin Sexton and Kevin Knox, among others. He's dead last in defense though. Next closest is his old friend Lou Williams, by the way. But Lou, you know, Trae Young, I said this before, I talked about it on Twitter a little bit. It is possible that Young is this bad defensively. I don't think I would say he's by far the best. He's by far the worst in the league, which is kind of the way the RPM is treating him. There's a pretty big gap between him and everybody else defensively. He's not that bad. Like, he's bad. And I think if you told me that he was a bottom 10 defender in the league, I probably would believe you. But I don't think he's also the worst by far, like the way that they're treating him. It's a slight distinction, but also one worth noting is that I don't think he's that bad, quote unquote. He is bad. That's not really up for debate, but something that's sort of the reason why he's been treated so poorly in RPM overall is that his defensive scene is just like legendarily bad, and it's not that bad, I don't think. Offensively, actually, Young's number 138 out of 438, so he's seen as a top, you know, third of the league player offensively, and still is a bottom seven player in the league in terms of the overall. So that just kind of tells you how bad they think his defense is in the stat. But, you know, even with his poor shooting numbers, I think RPM – treating his offense pretty well is not a bad sign, I would say. You know, it's one of the things where you don't want to make too much of it. I just talked about how you shouldn't make too much of it, you know, positively or negatively. But the fact that Young's offense is still treated okay is probably a good sign for him moving forward. So all that to say, RPM is something that I don't put a ton of stock in. It can be, you know, informative, I would say, is the best way to put that. But, it's pretty easy to spot outliers as well, especially if you're a team that you watch all the time, like I do with the Hawks. Like Devin's offense, Lynn's defense, for instance, are two pretty shining outliers on the page here. So, you know, and also it's early in the year. I think late in the year, maybe the data gets better. That's how most data works out when it comes to the NBA, whether it be lineup combinations, et cetera, stuff that can sort of normalize itself as the season goes on. So just keep that in mind as you're trying to evaluate this. It's probably too early for all these stats anyway, but you know, some of the stuff feels right, some of the stuff feels wrong, and it's not unique to this particular statistical system, and it won't be that moving forward either. So thank you for listening to the podcast, everybody. It's going to probably do it for today. We'll come back after the game Friday night. The Hawks are in Oklahoma City, and it'll probably be a little bit of a late night pod because the game's not until 8 Eastern, and I'll have to do some rewatching, all that fun stuff. But we'll have a podcast before Saturday morning arrives. Thank you for listening to the podcast. Please subscribe to the show, and we'll see you guys tomorrow night.